I realized how much consideration he had given the matter. We were going to sleep in a federal park in the Tennessee mountains. I guess he thought that because the park was federal land, most likely we would not run into any trouble there. The more I thought about it, the madder I got. Here I was forcing my white friends to sleep in a park because I was black and could not sleep in the same hotel with them. If it was not for me, they could have slept in one of those luxurious hotels. Reverend King and his wife were still asleep the next morning when Joan and I got up and wandered off through the park to find the restroom. We discovered showers there and decided to use them, since we seemed to have been the first to have gotten up that early. There were lots of parked cars around, but we didn't see anyone stirring. We thought we could manage to get a good shower before all the other people in the park got up. As we were finishing, two white women came in. They were from Georgia. We heard them talking as they used the toilets. Joan and I hadn't bothered to go back to the car and get towels. We were using the paper towels instead. When the women came back from behind the little partition that gave privacy to the toilets, they saw us standing in the middle of the floor, naked, drying each other's backs with paper. They didn't know how to react. It was a shock to them. Here we were, a black girl and a white girl, standing in a southern public shower, naked. I guess they thought we were having a nude-in or a wash-in or something. Anyway, they didn't stay around to watch the demonstration. As they were leaving, one sniffed, "Niggers everywhere." Getting back to the car, we found Reverend King and his wife awake. We told them that we had found some terrific showers without telling them the rest of the story, and they went off to shower too. Just before the Kings came back, several white women came snooping around the car. Joan and I were sitting in the back seat. We recognized two of them as the women from the showers. I guess they had found more women and gone back to the showers to beat us up. When they hadn't found us there, they had gone looking for us. For a while, they were all staring at the Mississippi license plate. They didn't know what to do. I guess they thought I was a maid or some kind of governess working for the owner of the car. When the Kings returned, the women really looked bewildered. Reverend King was wearing his clerical collar. He didn't look exactly old or rich, but just like one of those civil rights preachers. Before they could make up their minds what they were going to do about us, Reverend King and his wife got into the car and drove off, with Joan and me looking out the back window laughing. At this point, I think it dawned upon those ladies that we were, in their language, professional agitators. "Too bad," I cracked to Joan. "Now it's too late. That's a bunch of women for you." Fortunately, the drive through Alabama went without incident. We arrived in Canton about 6 p.m. Reverend King dropped me at the Freedom House and drove straight on to Tougaloo. It was too dangerous for white civil rights workers to be caught in Canton after dark. Chapter 25. Now that school was in session in Canton, I became more and more aware of the terrible poverty in the area. Many of the teenagers who had worked with us had been unable to return to classes because their parents had been fired from their jobs and could not afford to buy their children school clothes. Some of these teenagers had worked every summer to keep themselves in school, but this summer, because of the voter registration drive, had not been able to find jobs. To see those kids out of school standing around hungry all day sickened me. I felt so guilty, as if we were responsible. Just across the street from the office, a lady lived in a two-room house with her five children. She supported them and her sick father on the $5 that she earned doing domestic work. School had been open for 2 weeks, and I noticed that the two girls were home every day. When I asked them the first week why they weren't in school, I was told that the younger girl had mumps. The older one said that she had to stay home with the younger. The second week of school, I asked them again. This time, they told me the truth. Their grandfather had been terribly sick during the summer. The mother, after buying medicine for her father all summer long, was unable to buy clothes for them to wear to school. The oldest boy, who was 17 years old, had been able to buy clothes for himself and the other two boys, but not for his two sisters. With tears pouring down her cheeks, the oldest girl told me that they would be unable to go to school if they stayed out another week. My whole childhood came to life again. I thought of how my mother had suffered with us when we had been deserted by my father, how we went hungry all the time, never having anything to eat but bread, and on rare occasions, beans and bread. I was reminded of my sick grandfather, who looked after my sister and brother while I was in school. I remembered how he used to fish a dollar out of his money sack and give it to my mother to buy food with. All that I had vowed to forget and overcome came back to me. The life these kids were leading was a replica of my own past. When George returned from canvassing in the country with Mr. Chin, we had a 4-hour meeting trying to figure out how to get some clothes and food to needy families. After the meeting, Mr. Chin and George went to Greenwood to talk with the SNCC workers. We knew they were getting clothes in the Delta. Maybe they would agree to have the next shipment sent to Canton. Anyway, if anyone could convince them how badly we needed those things, CO could. The next day, I received my first $25 from Corps. Dave Dennis had been trying to get us on the payroll for about 2 months. George and I were finally being paid. There was also a $25 check for Mr. Chin. Looking at my check, I thought, "You didn't get here when I needed you before, but now you're right on time." I kissed it and headed across the street. Standing before the two girls on the porch, waving my check, I said, "We're in business. Let's go shopping. Tomorrow, you two go to school." "What?" the older one said. "Do you mean that? You see this check here? It says," and I pointed, "it says, pay to the order of Ann Moody, $25.
$25?
The younger one said. It was as if this was more money than she ever hoped to have. "That's right, and it's all ours," I said. "You two ready to go shopping?"
"Yes,"
they shouted simultaneously. "First, you two watch the office until I get back. I'm going up to the Washingtons to cash it." The Washingtons were well-to-do Negroes who owned a grocery store. They also rented us the Freedom House we were now staying in. They were the only ones in Canton who would cash our checks. None of the white stores or the Canton Bank would. In minutes, I was back to the office, and our shopping tour began. Our first stop was the 5 and 10. We found some tennis shoes on sale for a dollar and bought a pair for each girl. On another counter, we found some blouses for 50 cents. Then we picked up a dollar book sack for the younger girl, a 10-cent comb and 50-cent brush for each, and headed for the bargain store. There we found dresses on sale, 2 for $5. I bought each of them 2. Then 2 pencils for 5 cents and 2 10-cent tablets. It took only 35 minutes for us to do all this shopping. Realizing I still had money left, the younger girl said she was hungry. So our next stop was our favorite little restaurant where we could get bologna sandwiches for 10 cents. We had 2 sandwiches apiece and went back to the office. They seemed like the 2 happiest girls in the world, but I think I was even happier. When their mother got home, she came over and thanked me. She offered to pay me back when she got caught up. I told her to forget it, that people had done the same for me when I was small. She looked at me as if to say, "I believe you, otherwise you wouldn't have understood." The next day, the girls stopped in on their way to school. "Mama told us to let you see us and ask you if you want us to do anything for you when we get out of school," the older one said.
"Yes, there is something you can do for me," I said.
"You can go home and study real hard. Then
You might be able to make up for the 2 weeks you've missed. Now hurry on to school before you are late.
I watched them out of the window until they were out of sight. They were beaming, and so was I. Just as I was about to leave for the office, George and Mr. Chin drove in from the Delta. They had enough canned food and peanut butter with them to last a month. As they put the food in the house, I said, "I have a surprise for you two." George looked at me puzzled. "If someone was shot, I don't want to hear about it."
"It's good news."
"Did we have a fortune willed to us?"
Mr. Chin asked.
"Not exactly," I said.
"But the three of us got our $25 checks from Core yesterday."
"That ain't exactly a fortune," Mr. Chin said, "but right now it sounds like one."
"I have news for you, too," George said.
"Wait, let me brace myself."
I backed against the wall.
"Now, shoot.
We might get some clothes in next week. Snick has been getting quite a bit from the Delta. They have a big shipment coming in from a Jewish synagogue somewhere. We convinced them to send it straight to Canton."
"Are you kidding?"
I said.
"I hope they ain't lying to us," Mr. Chin said. "Anyway, they have enough food in Greenwood to keep us alive for a while. That I seen with my own eyes."
"In that case, we're in business," I said. A few days later, as George and I drove up to the office after a trip to Jackson, we found a big express truck outside. We jumped out of the car to see what it was. I had a feeling I knew, but I was afraid to find out it wasn't what I thought. As George got out of the car, the driver of the truck asked,
"Are you George Raymond?"
"Yes," George answered.
"We have a shipment of clothes here for you."
As we unloaded the boxes of clothes, I realized there was much more than we had expected. The office got so crowded we could barely move around in it. Boxes were stacked from the floor to the ceiling with little space left for us. I was so happy that they had come. They would help a lot of people, I thought. Maybe they would also help encourage Negroes to get out and vote. That was what had happened in the Delta. The rest of the week I worked on sorting out the clothes. It was hard work, but I was happy doing it. I was feeling great until the weekend. Then all of a sudden I became so depressed that I didn't even feel like seeing or talking to anyone. When Dave and his wife Maddie came to Canton on Saturday afternoon for a weekend staff meeting, I excused myself and went for a walk alone. I was afraid someone would ask me what was wrong and I would burst into tears. I had cried lots of times when things weren't going well with the project, but no one had ever seen me crying. I wasn't about to let anyone see me now. The others knew that I couldn't go home again, but no one knew of the agony I was going through because of it. I never told anyone about all the letters I was receiving from Mama, begging me to leave Mississippi and always telling me that my life was in danger. They all had their share of problems. They couldn't do anything about mine. Now that I was walking, tears were running down my cheeks. Tomorrow I would be 23 years old, I thought. I had never failed before to get a birthday card from Adeline or Mama. Mama was probably mad because I didn't answer her last letter. Why should I keep encouraging her to write anyway? I thought. She never writes me a cheerful letter. She couldn't possibly conceive of the things we're going through here. I knew she would never understand me if I tried to tell her why I felt I had to do the work I was doing. All she would say is what she always said. Negroes are going to have troubles until they're dead, and after you are dead, we'll still have the same problems. Finally, I headed back to the Freedom House. When I returned, I tried to be more cheerful, even though anyone could look at my eyes and tell I had been crying.
"Moody, come go shopping with me,"
Maddie said. "I'm not going to be long."
"Okay," I said,
knowing she wanted to talk with me and try to find out what was bothering me. As we were walking to town, she said, "What's wrong, Moody? Are you mad with us? It's not Dave's fault. He's tried to get someone to work in here with you all. People just don't want to come in here. Most of them are scared to work in Canton. You know that. Besides, Dave can't even get money to pay them. Dave thinks you're mad with him. You know how sensitive he is. He is trying, though, and he'll find somebody soon, I'm sure." "That's not what's wrong, Maddie," I said. "I know Dave is trying." "Then what is it?" she asked. "Did you get bad news from home? Are your people all right?" "I guess they're okay. It's just that tomorrow's my birthday, and I was kind of looking for a card from them. When the mailman came and I didn't get one, I felt bad about it," I said. "Why didn't you tell us? We could have planned something for you," she said. "You all have enough problems without worrying about whether I'm happy on my birthday or not," I said. She seemed very glad to hear I wasn't mad at Dave and ready to jump up and leave the project. While we were shopping, she insisted on buying me 2 pairs of pajamas that were on sale for my birthday. When we got back to the Freedom House, she called Dave into the bedroom. "She's probably telling him I'm not angry at him," I thought. They were in there a long time. When Dave came out, he was smiling. He began twisting to a record that was playing on the radio. "Come on, Ann. You ain't gonna let me finish this one by myself, are you?" he asked. I was beginning to feel better. "It's not that," I said. "I just don't want to show you up. My little brother twists better than that." "Is that your excuse? I dare you to challenge me," he said. I got up and began twisting with him. We were doing a pretty nasty twist when Maddie came into the room. "Ann Moody, how dare you dance with my husband like that?" she said. "I think you're bitching at the wrong person. I'm not married to you. Dave is," I said. "Dave, how dare you?" she scolded. "Come on, George," Dave said. "Let's go for a walk. Maddie is getting jealous." When they were gone, Maddie and I sat down and talked for a while, and then I started cooking dinner. By the time I had finished, Dave and George were back, carrying 2 large bags. "What have you 2 been buying?" I asked. "Food, food, food," George said. "Food? Where did you get the money? I thought you were broke." "Maddie is calling you, Ann," Dave said, meanwhile looking at the plate of fried chicken on the stove. "Did you call me Maddie?" I yelled to her. "Yes. Come here, Moody. Come here a minute," she said. "If you touch that chicken, Dave, I'll cut your hands off when I get back," I warned. "I'm going with you," he said. "So if Ann is missing, you know who did it." He looked at George, still standing there holding the 2 big bags. "Do you want to go over to Henry Chin's place tonight?" Maddie asked me. Henry Chin, CO's brother, ran the biggest Negro nightclub in town. "Dave, tomorrow is Annie's birthday." "No kidding. How old are you, Ann?" 19, he asked. 19, I said. "I'll be 23, and I look twice that old." 23, Dave said. "I thought you were going to say 50, so I could be kissing you from now until tomorrow." Then he started kissing me. "Dave Dennis, if you kiss Ann Moody again, I'll quit you," Maddie said. "Tomorrow is her birthday, and then you better not kiss her no 23 times." "You 2 are too damn jealous," I said. "Come on, let's eat." As I was taking something out of the refrigerator, I noticed 2 gallons of ice cream and a large coconut cake in the box.
So this is what George had in the bag, I thought. They're probably planning to give me a surprise birthday party. We didn't go out that night, but we had so much fun just being together. We sat around the house and played cards half the night and cracked jokes. We used to sit around and play bidwist almost every Saturday night. Half of the time, though, we were just sitting up because we were afraid someone would try to kill us after we went to bed. Sunday, September 15th, 1963, was my 23rd birthday. I got up about 9 that morning, feeling like 103. Everyone else was sleeping, so I just decided to let them sleep. After a shower, I started to fix breakfast, even though Maddie had promised to cook that morning. As soon as I finished, I got them up because we were supposed to have a staff meeting later. "Breakfast is ready! Breakfast is ready!" I called. Dave came running in the kitchen, yelling, "Maddie, shame on you! Today is Anne's birthday, and here she is cooking breakfast while you sleep." "Is today your birthday?" George asked, stumbling into the kitchen, as if he didn't know after buying 2 gallons of ice cream and a cake yesterday. "I'm sorry, Moody," Maddie said. "I heard you cooking, but Dave wouldn't let me get up."
"You tell that on me, Maddie," Dave said. "It was Maddie, Ann. She kept begging me, 'Just once more, Dave, just once more.'"
"Now who do you believe, Ann?" He was hugging Maddie, and both of them were trying to look at me with a straight face. We were all eating and listening to the radio when the music stopped abruptly in the middle of a record. "A special news bulletin just in from Birmingham," the DJ was saying. "A church was just bombed in Birmingham, Alabama. It is believed that several Sunday school students were killed." We all sat glued to our seats, avoiding each other's eyes. No one was eating now. Everyone was waiting for the next report on the bombing. The second report confirmed that 4 girls had been killed. I looked at George. He sat with his face buried in the palms of his hands. Dave sat motionless with tears in his eyes. Maddie looked at Dave as if she had been grounded by an electric shock. I put my hand up to my face. Tears were pouring out of my eyes, and I hadn't even known I was crying.
"Why? Why? Why? Oh, God, why? Why us? Why us?"
I found myself asking.
"I gotta find myself some woods, trees, or water, anything. I gotta talk to you, God, and you gotta answer. Please don't play Rip Van Winkle with me today."
I rushed out of the house and started walking aimlessly. I ran up a hill where there were trees. I found myself in a graveyard I didn't even know was there. I sat there looking up through the trees, trying to communicate with God.
"Now talk to me, God. Come on down and talk to me.
You know, I used to go to Sunday school when I was a little girl. I went to Sunday school, church, and BTU every Sunday. We were taught how merciful and forgiving you are. Mama used to tell us that you would forgive us 77 times a day, and I believed in you. I bet you those girls in Sunday school were being taught the same as I was when I was their age.
Is that teaching wrong? Are you going to forgive their killers?"
"You're not going to answer me, God, huh? Well, if you don't want to talk, then listen to me. As long as I live, I'll never be beaten by a white man again. Not like in Woolworths. Not anymore. That's out. You know something else, God? Non-violence is out. I have a good idea Martin Luther King is talking to you, too. If he is, tell him that non-violence has served its purpose. Tell him that for me, God, and for a lot of other Negroes who must be thinking it today.
If you don't believe that, then I know you must be white, too. And if I ever find out you are white, then I'm through with you. And if I find out you are black, I'll try my best to kill you when I get to heaven. I'm through with you. Yes, I am going to put you down. From now on, I am my own God. I am going to live by the rules I set for myself. I'll discard everything I was once taught about you. Then I'll be you. I will be my own God, living my life as I see fit. Not as Mr. Charlie says I should live it, or Mama, or anybody else. I shall do as I want to in this society that apparently wasn't meant for me and my kind. If you are getting angry because I'm talking to you like this, then just kill me. Leave me here in this graveyard dead. Maybe that's where all of us belong anyway. Maybe then we wouldn't have to suffer so much. At the rate we are being killed now, we'll all soon be dead anyway. When I got back to the Freedom House, Dave and Maddie were gone. I found George stretched out on his bed. What happened to Maddie and Dave? I asked. Dave was called for a meeting in Jackson, and they had to leave. Where have you been all this time?
Walking, I said.
Was there any more news about the bombing?
No,
he said. Except that the four girls were killed, and the city is getting pretty tense the closer it gets to dark. They'll probably tear Birmingham to bits tonight. I pray that they don't have any violence.
Pray?
Pray, George. Why in the hell should we be praying all the time? Those white men who hurled that bomb into the church today weren't on their knees, were they? If those girls weren't at Sunday school today, maybe they would be alive. How do you know they weren't on their knees? That's what's wrong now. We've been praying too long. Yes, as a race, all we've got is a lot of religion. And the white man's got everything else, including all the dynamite.
Hold it. Is that Miss Woolworth? The non-violent Miss Woolworth talking like that?
He asked. Let's face it, George. Non-violence is through, and you know it. Don't you think we've had enough of it? First of all, we were only using it as a tactic to show, or rather dramatize, to the world how bad the situation is in the South. Well, I think we've had enough examples. I think we are overdoing it. After this bombing, if there are any more nonviolent demonstrations for the mere sake of proving what all the rest of them have, then I think we are over-dramatizing the issue.
You feel like talking about anything else? He asked.
Yeah, let's talk about that beautiful march on Washington, I said, almost yelling. It was just about 2 weeks ago, believe it or not, and 250,000 people were there yelling, "We want freedom!" Well, I guess this bombing is Birmingham's answer to the march. But what's going to be our answer to the bombing? We're going to send more of our children right back to Sunday school to be killed? Then the president will probably issue a statement saying we are doing everything in our power to apprehend the killers, and we are in close touch with the situation. After which, we will still run out in the streets and bow our heads and pray to be spat upon in the process. I call that real religion, real, honest-to-goodness nigger religion. If Martin Luther King thinks nonviolence is really going to work for the South as it did for India, then he is out of his mind. On Monday, the day after the bombing, the Negroes in Canton were afraid to walk the streets. When they passed the office, they turned their heads to keep from looking in. Every time I passed one of them on the street, they looked at me and almost said,
get out of here. You get us killed. I left the office shortly after lunch. When I got to the Freedom House, I played freedom songs and tried to analyze what had happened thus far for us in the movement. I discovered my mind was so warped and confused, I couldn't think clearly. The church bombing had had a terrible effect on me. It had made me question everything I had ever believed in. There has got to be another way for us, I thought. If not, then there is no end to the misery we are now encountering. I put a Ray Charles record on the box, and he was saying, feeling sad all the time, that's because I got a worried mind. The world is in an uproar. The danger zone is everywhere. Read your paper, and you'll see just exactly what keep worrying me. It seemed as though I had never listened to Ray before. For the first time, he said something to me. George came in later, bringing a girl with him. Anne, I would like for you to meet Lenora. She might be working with us. She was kicked off her father's plantation. Why? I asked. It seems as though she was thinking like you yesterday, after the bombing. Somehow it got back to her father's boss man, and she left running last night. I knew that he brought her here because he wanted me to have some other person to talk to. If you can't go home, then don't go feeling like the Lone Ranger, I said. I haven't been home since Thanksgiving of 61. I know a lot of other people that can't go home either. So you see, you have plenty of company. She grinned like a silly little country girl. Where are you living now? I asked. Are you working? In the project with an aunt, she answered. I had a job, but... Then why don't you move in with us? I asked. We need some help, and maybe we can get you on the payroll. But you won't be making much money. I wondered, though, how long we could stay in the area ourselves before the Negroes asked us to leave. Chapter 26. Lenora moved in the next day. The only thing she had to move was a shopping bag. She didn't come with any clothes, just Lenora. That night, she opened the icebox and found 2 gallons of ice cream.
Moody, what's the ice cream for? Can I have some? She asked.
Sure, Lenora, help yourself. It was for my birthday, which was Sunday, I said. There's a coconut cake in there, too, if you'd like some.
You want me to fix some for you? She asked.
No, thanks, I said. I don't think I could eat it. But suddenly, I had an idea. We could use the ice cream and cake to give a party for the high school students. Maybe a party would stir up their enthusiasm again. I couldn't wait till George came in to ask him what he thought about it. We gave the party Saturday night, and it turned out to be a great success. There were so many high school students there that finally the party became a rally. We all went out in the yard and sat on the grass and sang freedom songs for hours. One of the students told me that the principal of the high school had forbidden anyone to come. I was glad he had. It seemed to have boosted attendance. 10 students volunteered to speak in church services throughout the county on Sunday and to spread the word about the clothes we were going to give out the following Wednesday. They did such a good job spreading the word that when Lenora and I turned the corner to the office early Wednesday morning, there were about 200 Negroes already in line outside it. The minute I saw them there, I got mad as hell. Here they are, I thought, all standing around waiting to be given something. Last week after the church bombing, they turned their heads when they passed this office. Some even looked at me with hate in their eyes. Now they are smiling at me. After I give them the clothes, they probably won't even look at me next week, let alone go and register to vote. As Lenora and I opened the door,
The crowd almost trampled us in the rush to get inside. We told them nothing would be given out until Annie Devine, a Negro insurance lady, arrived. She knew most of the families, and we hoped her presence would help prevent people from taking things they could not use. While we all waited, the Negroes were making comments about the clothes. Some said things like, "Them white folks in the North is some good," or, "Look at them clothes, just as brand new as they came out of the store." When I told them that I would like to have their names and addresses so we could inform them of the next shipment, they all looked like they were ready to leave the office. I heard one lady whisper, "It's just a trick to get us to vote." I found myself wanting to deliver a sermon, but instead, I left a pencil and paper on the back desk next to the door and asked them to put down their name and address as they left. After this, the tension eased. I knew they would not leave their names. Just in case, however, I stationed Mrs. Chin at the back of the office. Over and over again, I could hear her saying, "You people needn't be scared or ashamed to sign your names. We ain't gonna use them to get none of you in trouble. All Anne and the rest of these call workers are here to do is help you people. They have even been trying to get food to some of you." It took us all day to give the clothes out. I had never in my life seen people who were so much in need. After we gave out most of the best coats and things, people started coming up to me, telling me that they were desperate for a coat, a pair of shoes, anything. At 5 o'clock, I was exhausted. I looked at Mrs. Devine and Lenora and saw that their hair was white from the dust and the lint from the clothes. When I looked in the mirror, I discovered mine was too. Around 5:30, a group of people who had just gotten off work came to the office. I told them that everything was gone. A lady looked at a box of clothes in the corner and asked, "Can I go through these? I might find something I can use in there." "If you would like to, yes, but these things aren't that good. Most of them are just rags," I told her. Before I could finish answering her, she had begun to search through the things. About 5 other women and 2 men joined her. They turned the box over on the floor, pulling everything out. They were snatching for old rags and panties and bras. The men were taking shorts that didn't even have elastic in the waist or were without seats. When they left, Lenora burst out laughing. "You see, Anne, I told you they weren't rags." "I see that," I said, "and I don't think it's funny. It's a damn shame people have to be this poor in America, the land of plenty." "Well, Anne, we've started them now. We have to get some more clothes, else a lot of Negroes will be plenty mad because they were left out," Mrs. Devine said. "We'll never get enough clothes to supply all of the Negroes in Madison County," I answered. "I think we would do better trying to get them jobs so they can buy their own." "I could sure use one," Mrs. Chin sighed. "I ran out of food 3 days ago." "How many signed their names, Mrs. Chin?" I asked, deliberately changing the subject. Every time she talked about her financial condition, she got terribly depressed. I not only got depressed, but felt guilty about the way she and C.O. exerted themselves to help us and how much they had suffered because of it. "Only 20, she said. "It's a shame. Some of them had the nerve to tell me, 'Minnie Lou, I can't sign my name, but you know me. Let me know when you people get some more clothes in.' I felt like killing them. If it was left up to me, I wouldn't give them anything. That's all niggers is good for, looking for something for nothing." When Lenora and I opened the office the following morning, people were constantly dropping by to see if we had any more clothes. However, when I asked if they were registered to vote, the answer was always no. And none of them had any intentions of trying to register in the immediate future. I began to have the feeling that either we came up with an idea or project better than voter registration, or we would have to get out of Canton. A few days later, a Negro high school girl, picking cotton after school out in the country, was raped by a white farmer. The news was whispered throughout Canton. All the Negroes thought it was horrible, but none of them stopped sending their children to pick cotton. They had no choice. The little money the teenagers made from picking cotton kept them in school. In Madison County, the use of teenage labor during the cotton picking season was an institution. The Negro schools actually closed at noon the first 2 months of the school year so that the students would be able to work for the white farmers. Their own parents, who had almost as much land as the whites but received much smaller allotments from the government, practically starved. Most of them couldn't even afford to give their children lunch money and buy them school supplies. This fall, the cotton picking in Madison County continued as usual, and the man who had raped the girl went around talking about it and saying things like, "Them niggas even got the nerve to complain about getting rid of a little pussy since that damn organization," meaning CORE, "moved in." One of his friends remarked, "I used to could pick up a nigger any time. Now they is all scared somebody might see them." Because the girl came to the CORE office and filled out an affidavit, her father had to resort to packing a gun to protect his family. After that, several open assaults were made on young Negro girls by the white men in the area. The assaults provoked a lot of talk concerning other affairs. For about a week or so, the talk went on and on about what white man was screwing which Negro woman. It came out in the open that some of the top officials of Madison County had Negro mistresses that they lived with almost full time. It was Centerville all over again. It was now 3 weeks since the Birmingham church bombing, and during this time the Klan had been extremely busy. What I feared most was that the threats would stop and action would begin, that I would see a bunch of Klansmen riding through Canton. If this ever happened, I was sure the streets of Canton would flow with blood for days. We had been through enough to know that as long as the threats kept coming, nothing was immediately planned to terrorize the Negroes. Out of compassion and sisterhood for me, Doris Erskine, my old jail buddy from Jackson, had finally consented to work with us in Canton. Once she arrived, there were four of us working in the area, and we again attempted to set up the nightly workshops. We also planned another Saturday night party for the high school students. One day, Doris and I went over to the high school campus to announce the party. The principal was one of the worst toms in Canton. He had placed some informers on the school grounds to let him know if any CORE people came around. As Doris and I were making our way through a crowd of students, he came running up to us. "May I speak to you two ladies in my office?" he said angrily.
"Oh, Mr. Principal," I said,
as if I hadn't even noticed him before.
"Why, we were just leaving.
I would love to chat with you for a while, but I'm afraid I don't have the time. I have a meeting in about 5 minutes at the office. Maybe we can get together one day next week."
"Good evening, Mr. Principal. We'll be leaving now," Doris said.
As we walked away, he just stood there with his mouth wide open, not knowing what to say. Some of the students snickered at him. I thought it was pretty damn cool, the way we left him hanging there. Many more high school students came to the second party than had come to the first. We sang freedom songs for 4 hours. I was told by one of the students that the principal, again, had threatened to expel any of the students that came to the party. He said that after this threat got around campus, some of the students formed a group to solicit for party participants. Meanwhile, the principal had asked the chief of police to have us arrested if we ever came on campus again. The chief agreed and also saw fit to promise that we would be arrested if we were ever caught trying to persuade the students to stay out of school. Every day, the chief and his boys would hang around the high school at the lunch hour, just in case we showed up. They would also be stationed there when school let out for the day. The teenagers seemed to be very aroused over the principal's actions. On Monday, they left school and held a rally in an open space behind the Boyd Street housing project. I wanted so badly to attend it, but I knew the teenagers had to make their own decisions. I was glad that they had decided to act independently. When the rally was over, the students marched in and around the Boyd Street projects, singing freedom songs, with the chief and two carloads of police driving alongside them. Lenora, Doris, and I sat watching from the steps of the Freedom House, guarded by two cops in a parked car. As we sat there, George came running up and told us that he had almost been arrested by the chief. He said that we had been accused of starting the demonstration. Early that same evening, we were told that the police would raid the Freedom House late one night during the week. They evidently planned to frame Doris, Lenora, and me on some kind of prostitution charge and hoped our arrest would cause so much public dissension that we would be forced to leave Canton. George, the only guy in the house, decided not to stay with us for a while in case the police went ahead with their plan. All that first night, police rode by, shining flashlights on the Freedom House. Later on, when they discovered that only girls were living in the house, they began to harass us every night of the week. We became afraid to stay there. Until dawn, cars would pass by and bricks would be thrown at the windows. I was nervous, but I wasn't as bad as Doris when it came to nerves. She was afraid to sleep in a room alone. Some nights, she and Lenora would both come in and sleep with me. Often, we would talk all night to keep from falling asleep. After a week, I was so tired I felt like I was dying on my feet. I felt as though I hadn't had a good night of sleep since coming to Canton. We opened up two or three workshops in the country again, and that made things worse. We no longer had our protective guys riding around with us. Most of them had gone north or to California trying to find jobs. Now either George went with us or we went alone. Doris and I were coming from a workshop 26 miles out in the country one night when we were chased by a group of drunken whites. Doris panicked. She began driving like a crazy woman, making every curve on two wheels, sending rocks sailing everywhere. I just knew we would turn over in a ditch and be killed. I wondered whether it would be better to force Doris to stop or to jump out of the car into a ditch, as Doris turned a curve, hoping the other car would pass without seeing me. If I forced Doris to stop the car, I thought, maybe we would just be beaten or raped by the drunks and not killed. Finally, I just closed my eyes and hoped that whatever would happen wouldn't take too long or be too painful. I must have blacked out, because when I opened my eyes, we were at the Freedom House. The next night, George went with us, but the fear was still there. All the jokes we were able to come up with couldn't erase the experience we had encountered on those long, dark country roads. I came to the Freedom House one evening and found Doris sitting in a chair with a rifle across her lap and Lenora oiling a pistol. "Hey, what in the hell is going on here?" I said. I stood there with my mouth wide open. "Eyes are oiling my gun," said Lenora. "This here baby is taking a nap," said Doris. "Come on now, cut that shit out. Where did you two get those guns?" I asked. "I've had this one a long time," Lenora said in her normal voice. "Where did you get the rifle, Doris?" "Well, Moody, some nice colored man was kind enough to lend it to me," she said. "Are we going to have a real shoot it out with the Klan tonight? If so, where is my piece?" "No. We just kinda figured we needed some protection around the house. After all, three young women just don't live in Mississippi alone without any protection.
Seriously, did we get a threat for tonight?
Don't we get them every night? Doris asked.
I stood there looking at them, thinking, these fools are out of their minds. What in the hell would we do with two guns against all the dynamite and ammunition the Klan has?
I guess they are beginning to feel like a lot of other Negroes I know. If you can't beat them, join them. Match fire with fire instead of kneeling and praying while some white cracker shoots you to death or throws a few sticks of dynamite on you and blows you to hell or somewhere. I figured if some Negro was kind enough to bring a gun to the Freedom House for us to protect ourselves with, then they must be gathering ammunition to protect the community. Now that we had a gun around the house, my fear seemed to get worse. I was constantly wondering whether the man that brought the rifle was paid by the whites to bring it. If the cops caught us with guns in the Freedom House, they would surely have a perfect excuse to arrest us. I knew I couldn't talk Lenora and Doris into giving them back. In fact, I was not sure I wanted to. Just about every night, cops were flashing lights on the house. If they weren't flashing lights, they were out there talking loud and laughing, trying to keep us awake. One night, a man came by with a truckload of big bloodhounds and canine police-type dogs. He let them out in front of the Freedom House, and they ran all around, scenting everything. He left them there a while, and then drove back and whistled for them to jump up in the truck. This frightened the hell out of us. Night after night, the dogs were brought to the house, and Doris and Lenora would stay awake, threatening to shoot them. I knew that this was the Klan's doing. I figured they were probably planning to burn down the house one night and run us out to be devoured by the dogs. It had gotten to the point where my weight was going down to nothing. I was just skin and bones. My nerves were torn to shreds, and I was losing my hair. I had been so happy when Doris first came to work with us, but now her presence only reminded me of what fear could do to a person. At this point, I would much rather have been in jail with her. When we were in jail, she had been one of the jolliest girls in my cell. She had been damn good at helping to keep up the morale of the high school girls when there were 500 of us at the fairgrounds concentration camp. But so much had happened here in Canton that I guess the thought of working here had messed her up even before she came. Lenora was different. If she was really scared, she didn't show it very much. Anyway, she was born in Madison County and knew a lot about the white people there. Sometimes we would get a threat and she would say things like, "If they were going to kill us, they wouldn't do it like that." I was always interested in her comments about the threats. I actually wondered sometimes whether she had been placed in the Freedom House by the whites. After all, I would think, she is from this county, and she doesn't seem to be upset over the threats and things. Whenever I found myself doubting one of the workers, I immediately dismissed the idea from my mind. I knew that kind of thinking could eventually destroy us. I knew the mind was tricky, and often the whites were smart enough to make our own minds work against each other to divide us. This I had learned from the Jackson movement, when they used the newspapers to play up a split in the organizations which did not exist. In order to sleep at night, I finally had to resort to sleeping pills. Doris began sleeping in the same bed as me, her rifle standing in the corner right at her head. Lenora slept in the back room with her pistol on the nightstand. At the sound of anything, they were up, peeping out of the window with guns in their hands. It had gotten to the point we had to wake each other up when one of us needed to use the bathroom. Doris slept so lightly, I would just touch her and she would jump up, grabbing for the rifle. Then I would call Lenora until she answered. I was scared that if I had gone to the bathroom and stumbled over something and Doris and Lenora heard me, they would have shot the hell out of me. In mid-October, we attended a COFO meeting. COFO was a statewide coalition of all the national civil rights groups in Mississippi. The meeting had been called to decide about running Aaron Henry, the state NAACP president and chairman of COFO, and Ed King of Tougaloo on a freedom ballot in the upcoming election for governor and lieutenant governor of Mississippi. It was believed more Negroes would cast their votes in the freedom election than were registered already. COFO planned to rally up enough support so that thousands of Negroes in various counties might participate. This, they thought, would prove to the nation that Negroes wanted to vote and would vote if they were not afraid to do so. I couldn't see us mobilizing the Negroes around a false campaign. We had enough problems getting them registered to vote, period. As it was, they had shown very little interest in the gubernatorial election since Coleman, the liberal Democrat, had lost to Paul Johnson in the primary. Now that the only choice was between the Republican, Rubel Phillips, and Johnson, the Negroes just didn't give a damn. At the COFO meeting, Aaron Henry asked the workers for their opinions about the freedom vote. I voiced my opposition to the whole idea. Right after that, an NAACP member from Clarksdale got up and went on and on about how she thought it was such a good thing. She ended with, "I don't think the young lady," meaning me, "has worked with Negroes in Mississippi. To my knowledge, most of the Negroes in Mississippi would participate in such an election." She made me so mad I was standing before she was seated. "For your information, Mrs. P., not only was I born in Mississippi, but I just happened to be born in Wilkinson County in southwest Mississippi, the toughest spot in the state. Because of my civil rights activities the last 2 years at Tougaloo, I have been barred from Wilkinson County. For the last 5 months, I have been working in Canton, another stronghold of the Klan. I think that should qualify me to have an opinion about the matter and a right to voice it." I took my seat, and an old man got up. "I think that young lady was right," he said. "We should be thinking of some other way to impress upon the people of the county the importance of the vote. If we hold this freedom vote, all the white folks is going to say is that we want to take over everything, that we want to rule things. I just want to be represented and given the right to vote in all the official elections. If I am asked to vote in an unofficial election, then that right is taken away by my own people." Aaron Henry decided to select a committee to settle the issue. As it turned out, I was the only person on the committee opposing the freedom election. However, once it was decided to hold it, I reluctantly agreed to try to get votes. The following week, Dave came into Canton to move two of us out to work on the freedom vote in other areas. Doris volunteered to go to Natchez, and Lenora was sent into Hattiesburg. Doris had only been in Canton a little over a month, and she was glad to get away. I had become too valuable in Canton to be moved, since I was now well known by most of the Negroes. Besides that, I didn't have the energy to go into an entirely new area. I would not have been able to stand the strain. We had only 3 weeks to rally up the Negro vote. Mrs. Devine and Mrs. Chin helped me in Canton, while George, Mr. Chin, and a few other men worked throughout the county. It was hard trying to explain the freedom election to the local Negroes. Most of them couldn't understand what we were trying to do. They thought we were trying to trick them in some way. By this time, I had finally realized that the future of the Negroes in Mississippi didn't depend upon the older people. They were too scared and suspicious. It was almost hopeless to try and educate minds that had been closed for so long. All their lives, their minds had been conditioned to Mr. Charlie's do's and don'ts. If we wanted to educate the vote, I thought, we should have been working with minds that were susceptible to change, ones that were open, inquisitive, and eager to learn. I had a feeling that the whites in Canton knew that, too. Why else had those 5 teenagers been shot at the beginning of our work in the area? In addition to working on the election, we were planning to send 5 farmers from Madison County to the National Sharecroppers Funds Conference in North Carolina. This project had my full support. Here were farmers with acres and acres of land who couldn't make a living off it. If they were able to get larger cotton allotments or find some other use for their land, perhaps get FHA loans to build up their farms, it would provide them with economic stability. This possibility really excited me. If there were 29,000 independent Negroes in Madison County instead of 29,000 starving Negroes, I was sure things would be different. We decided to call a meeting of the farmers. George and Mr. Chin were in Greenwood the night it was scheduled, so Mrs. Chin and I took charge of it. About 35 farmers and their wives showed up in the office. I was sitting by the window at a makeshift desk writing down names when I noticed that some of the farmers were shaking. They were facing the open door. I looked out of the window to discover about 6 cops standing outside, peeping at the meeting. The farmers kept shaking as I tried to get the information out of them. They just muttered their names. Finally, I got up and closed the door. When I did that, the cops moved to the side of the building and began peeping in the window. I immediately slammed it down. The panes in the window were painted black, but there was one missing. I covered the opening with one of the long sheets of paper I was writing on. "That's a smart bitch," I heard one of the cops comment. "Yeah, we gotta teach that black bitch a lesson," another one answered. I got kind of worried about the lesson they might teach me, but I was pleased by the reaction of the farmers. The instant they could no longer see the cops staring them in the face, they relaxed. The names came through loud and clear now. To my surprise, 2 or 3 of the farmers had already gotten FHA loans. Most of them, however, didn't know anything about them. They were all eager to go to the conference. When the meeting was over, one of the farmers gave Mrs. Chin and me a ride home. I was staying at her house since George was away. As soon as we got to the office the next morning, a lady who lived across the street came running in. "Anne!" "I was sitting on the porch and I saw what you did to them cops last night." "Honey, you don't know these cops here in Canton. Last night, after you slammed that window in their faces, they waited in the alley about 2 hours for you."
"Them dirty bastards," said Mrs. Chin. "I wish they had come by my house looking for Anne. I would have blown their heads off. I'm going to show you the one that wanted to beat you up, Anne," said the lady. "You watch out for him. He's a mean thing." Before she could finish telling me who to watch out for, 2 cops drove up outside and started parking their car. "That's him that's driving, Anne," said the lady. I looked them over. The one she referred to was slightly older than me. His general features were those of a pleasant person. However, those hating eyes of his were unbearable. I looked at him and wondered how a person that young could hate so much. Could he be so angry just because I slammed a window in his face? There was more to it than that. Maybe he was trying to prove a point. Maybe he was disturbed about something. He seemed more like the type that would rape me rather than beat me up, I thought. Mrs. Chin walked outside with the lady who had brought us the news. She went over to the car, and I heard her say,
You cops don't have anything better to do than sit in front of this office all the time. If you don't, I wish you would find something. I get tired of looking at you.
They looked at Mrs. Chin and didn't say a word. Had any other Negro woman in Canton said that, they would have beaten her down to the ground. But they knew she was C.O. Chin's wife, and no one, black or white, insulted C.O. Chin's people and got away with it. A few days later, Doris was back. She had tried to help get Negroes in Natchez organized and failed. From what she said, the Klan ruled the entire area. Cor didn't get enough cooperation from the Negroes to be able to stay. Doris seemed to have undergone quite a change. She was twice as scared as before. Now she was jumping in broad daylight. She still insisted on sleeping with me, with her rifle in the corner. The county fair in Canton was the next coming attraction for Negroes in Madison County. Because the fair was segregated, a week for whites and a few days for Negroes, we thought at first of boycotting it. However, since we could use it as a means of contacting Negroes, we decided not to. Thousands of Negroes usually flock to the fair from all around the county. We made special leaflets to pass out to them advertising the freedom vote. The first day the fair was open to Negroes, Doris and I found hundreds of them just as we expected. We ran into a group of high school students who had worked for us, and soon